Hi. Okay, cool. Oh, golly. I'm just thank you, Doug and Deborah, again. Every week is such a joy. Hi, Jack. How are you? Hi, everybody. I'm always just so blown away by these sessions, and it's a delight to be able to share some of the little tidbits that each of us have picked up about the Course. When we put all of our tidbits together, it sheds so much light on some of the things that can seem a little obscure. I wanted to follow up on what Doug was saying toward the very end. Bless you guys, both Doug and Deborah. Just you're wonderful. What you do here is just such a gift, and I want to thank you. But to follow up on what you were talking about, how we look past the limitations that others see for themselves in the moment, that follows up on what I was talking about last week, about how we extend the fatherhood of God every time we give a loving gesture or an encouraging word or are inspired to see someone as further along the path than they're manifesting at the moment. It's just an incredible thing to call forth the Christ in our brothers by extending the love of God to them instead of pushing them back into the limitations of the five sensory perception that the body seems to rule our lives with such a sense of limitation and tyranny. But I wanted to extend that idea that you were talking about, we get what we expect from others. As an anthropologist when I was studying in college, and these are old examples, and I can't give you the citations for them, but they hugely impressed me with the power that we have on each other. The Course says our influence on each other is infinite, and these old anthropological examples from my college days were incredibly useful for me, and I wanted to share them with you as a follow-up to what Doug said. Most people are aware of a fairly recent study, like in the last 30 years, on children in a school where they decided to see if the teacher's attitude toward the children had any effect on their capabilities. So they divided some students who were all average students. There weren't any stars. There weren't any people that you would classify as slow learners. They were all average students, and they took them and they divided them into two groups. And they informed the teachers of the two different groups that one group was composed of underachievers, really difficult kids with learning disabilities. And the other group was a cluster of stars, that these kids had infinite potential, that they were bright, and that they were cooperative. And the study revealed at the end that each of the groups performed precisely as described, that the teacher's attitude was the only difference between those two groups of people. And it's such a stunning example that you get from people what you expect from them. And here it is, it's a clinical study, and it's held true. If it was just more widely known that this is what happens, I think the whole world would change. But there are also two other very interesting old studies that I'd like to share with you right now. When Doug was talking about, you know, the parent keeps saying to the child that they're bad, and then they get a bad child as a result. One of the studies that we were taught when I was in college was, there was a country in Africa, and I'm not sure whether it's Nigeria or Liberia. I always get those confused. But in that country, one of the tribes has a tradition of naming their children after the day of the week on which they're born. So there are only seven given names for males in that country. They're named after the days of the week. And the days of the week are not our days in English. They're tribal names. And this was taken as a for instance. It was noticed by someone that something like 80% of the professional level people from that tribe in that country were born on Saturday. And it's an equivalent number, something like 80% of the people who were imprisoned for you know, doing violent crimes and things like that, were born on Sunday. And they were thinking, what in the world was that all about? And when they looked into it, the word that's the name for Saturday is good, and the word for the name of Sunday is bad. So if you were named after the day you were born, you were told constantly, if you were born on Saturday, that you were good. And if you were born on Sunday, you were told constantly you were called bad. I mean, that was your name, bad. And so bad did bad, and good did well. So I thought that made an impression on me. That was an interesting piece of information. But it also, there's another study that talks about how much, you know, the culture in which we're born and its norms have physical effects. And one of those studies that we were taught about was a study in China. And it was noted in China before the TV and the internet and things like that made global communication so prevalent. When China was very backward and very isolated, there were no documented cases of stuttering among the population in China. They simply didn't have a concept for stuttering. In the Western world, stuttering is a fairly common and understood phenomenon, and it comes from a nervousness, an insecurity. It becomes a neurological pattern in the brain, and then becomes very difficult to overcome. But it is something, it's an accepted defense mechanism. It's a taught behavior, that stuttering is something that is in the collective consciousness in the West, and so it's fairly common. In China, that concept just did not exist until there were Chinese Americans and Chinese living in Europe and places like that. People of direct Chinese descent started to have a problem with stuttering, and it was just unheard of in China. But once communication of things like stuttering became available to the population in China, then they started to have native examples of stuttering. This, to me, is the kind of thing that absolutely demonstrates that what the Course is telling us is true. We have an infinite degree of influence on each other, and we can choose to call forth that positive aspect. We can see the Christ. We can look past the physical appearance of the limitations and the accomplishments of a person, and we can call forth the best of them if we so choose. And it's just such a huge, important concept that it's something that if it were stressed more in our dealings with our brothers, I believe we would see changes in our immediate world, our immediate environment, that has to send ripples out to the larger collective. So anyway, I hope that wasn't boring for you, but those are the kinds of little tidbits that I was bringing with me when I first got the course, and when we got the Urtext in 2000. We just, by the way, passed the 10-year anniversary of that. I don't know if anybody wanted to celebrate it, but it was on the summer solstice in 2000 that the Urtext was found. So we've had it for 10 years now. Tom and I celebrated. We had a good little party about that. Anyway, but when I was reading things like this in the Urtext for the first time, I had these past experiences to draw upon and to understand just how profound those statements are and how profoundly it's been proven to affect people, that we affect each other by how we treat each other so incredibly. Now, does that mean that if you treat someone well, they're going to respond well? That's an offering of a miracle. You have offered love. It's their free will and their free choice whether to accept it or not. And we have to honor everyone's free will to accept the love and respond positively, or, as is so often the case, to be resistant to the love and to appear to be acting badly, and to just accept them and to see that somewhere down the road it is guaranteed that that miracle that you've offered for them is waiting for them when they're ready, and it will eventually be accepted. It is guaranteed. No offer of love is ever wasted, and no miracle, and every miracle is eventually received. And we just have to trust in the process. There's that old word, trust, again. So anyway, I hope I haven't bored you to tears with those little examples. Anyway, when Doug was reading what was on the board, he read that I had posted exactly. And because it wasn't in context, it probably didn't make any sense to anybody. But when I said it, when I typed it in and said it, it was when Doug was talking about the rules for decision, which coincidentally is my topic for today. So anyway, how many people here have ever, oh, well, bless your heart, thank you. I aim for not being boring, but I'm never sure because anthropologists are interested in such trivial seeming things that we're great at cocktail parties, but horrible at the everyday world. Anyway, getting back to what I was talking about, the rules for decision. So many people are, especially when they're new to the course, when they're first coming to the course, they're looking for commandments in the course. Have you ever noticed that? Ah, well, thank you. Thank you. Yes, I am an anthropologist. Lifelong training, if never actually using it. But it has come in incredibly handy. And I always thought it was a dead end, that I had spent an awful lot of years of study in these strange little cultural tidbits, only to read in the Urtext, Jesus telling Helen that if she looked over her life, that all of the pieces were connected. This is kind of a preamble, I guess, to actually getting to my topic. But that is something that I found was true of my life, and I bet every single person here, if you look back over your life, there were some things that you thought may have been detours, that may have been wasted effort. Interests like mine in anthropology that never seemed to pay off, in quotes. It never really became a profession where I could earn money at it. But my interest was always there, and it was always lively, and I was always taking advantage of it when my ex-husband and I used to travel overseas and things like that. I'd do my own little personal anthropological studies, if not nothing scientific about them. Nothing that could be published. But anyway, if you look back over your life, Jesus says to Helen, and the same has, it blew me away when I read that, because everything in my life was woven together into what I understood from the Course and how I implemented the Course and how I think my practice may look a little different from your practice and from anybody else's practices, because we come to the Course with all of these tendrils of life experience that those of us who are really dedicated to the Course, I think, see how all of those tendrils of past experience are brought together and explained, and all of a sudden, you know, all these aha moments seem to come from all of those things that we thought may have been just dead ends. So, anyway, back to the topic. There are so many people who want to know why there are no commandments in A Course in Miracles. And aside from the golden rule, which Jesus kind of borrowed, for those of you who aren't familiar, Jesus kind of borrowed that golden rule that Christians are taught from an early age, from a rabbi who lived about, he may have been contemporaneous with Jesus' life, but we know that around 30 or 40 BC, there was a guy named Rabbi Hillel, and he was challenged one time to recite the Torah while standing on one foot. And what he did, he stood on one foot, and he said, love God with all your heart, all your strength, all your soul, all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. all the rest of the Torah is commentary. Isn't that beautiful? And Jesus said, and it came down to us as the Golden Rule, and the Course refers to the Golden Rule. So what that is addressing is cause and effect, projection. Perception is a result of projection. It is telling us not commandments, not avoiding temptation. It's not giving us rules of the road. It's explaining to us how reality works. And then leaving it up to our own free will to decide whether or not we want to work in alignment with reality, or if we want to continue to fight reality and beat ourselves up as a result. And the Course says, now that you know the how reality works, the cause and effect of reality, now what you need is a tool. And he gives us that tool in chapter 30, as Doug said. So anyway, I'm not able to read the board, so I hope you don't mind if I just start reading that section on the rules for decision, because to me, all of the theory and all of the things that we can discuss about our own ideas about what the Course is saying and our own definitions of the words in the Course really boil down to the rules for decision. Are we actually implementing the rules for decision in our practice, day to day, moment to moment, actually? And what kind of results is that practice getting for you? And everybody who is doing the rules for decision on a regular basis, until it becomes their natural response, the Course says you do this quantitatively until there is a qualitative shift for you. And that's what we're doing. We're disciplining ourselves to utilize this tool, the rules for decision, until there is a shift of perception. It is no longer something that we have to discipline ourselves to do. It is our natural reaction to any discomfort. Again, that idea that discomfort is there simply as an alert that healing or correction is needed. There's a line in the Ur text that I really like. It says that very few people understand the therapeutic value of pain or discomfort or fear, in that it's it's a motivator for change. And so when we're in discomfort, if we can look at that and say, hey, this is a red flag. This is like coming to a big red stop sign at an intersection. And it says, you know, the pain that's come up says, okay, you can proceed across this intersection and go the way you were going. And if you don't stop and examine it, you might get hit at this intersection. Probably will get hit. If we start to look at pain and unhappiness as signs that whenever we're experiencing them, we need to go to the rules for decision and see the changes that occur first in ourselves and then in the seemingly external world, which really isn't external because it is a direct result of the extension or projection of our inner state of mind. So anyway, here are the rules for decision, and I hope you'll bear with me because these are crucial. Okay. Again, this is from chapter 30. Decisions are continuous. You do not always know when you are making them. But with a little practice in the ones you recognize, a set begins to form which sees you through the rest. I'm going to stop right there. This is huge. He's saying that we very rarely recognize that we're making decisions. There's a place in the Course that says that everything, even death, is a decision. One of the things that it says is that we make these choices so fast that they're not even consciously made. Again, psychological studies have shown that 95% of the decisions that we make throughout our day are done unconsciously. And this little line that I just read said, just the decisions that you recognize, the maybe 5% of your decision-making through your day, if you take charge of those, then the set begins to form around those consciously made decisions that starts to permeate the unconscious ones. I hope that makes sense. But it is absolutely crucial to making the way of the Course, the way that we respond to the world. And it does change everything when we do that. Okay, to begin the reading again. It is not wise to let yourself become preoccupied with every step you take. The proper set, adopted consciously each time you wake, will put you well ahead. And if you find resistance strong and dedication weak, you are not ready. Do not fight yourself. That's in all caps. Do not fight yourself. That's one of the things that I'm going to stop right there and say has given me personally great comfort through the years, especially the last 10 years when I saw that in all caps. Do not fight yourself. Understand that there is a resistance. If you have to force yourself to do this, if your dedication is weak and your resistance is strong, that's one of those red stop signs. And it's saying, instead of forcing yourself to do the form, stop and look at the resistance and ask to be shown what that resistance is stemming from, what the cause of that is. Because your resistance and your lack of dedication are symptoms that simply cannot be disregarded or overridden except without great effort, and really don't allow for the healing behind them to occur. If you simply steamroll yourself into discipline instead of looking at the resistance, you're not going to have as great of a healing effect. So recognize that. Don't fight yourself, but stop right where you are and look at where that resistance is coming from with the Holy Spirit. Allow that to be healed step by step, and you'll see much lower resistance to doing the practice, and your dedication will become natural, not a discipline. So, back to the reading. But think about the kind of day you want and tell yourself there is a way in which this very day can happen just like that. Then try again to have the day you want. Point number one, or rule number one, the outlook starts with this. Today I will make no decisions by myself. This means that you are choosing not to be the judge of what to do. But it must also mean that you will not judge the situations where you will be called upon to make response. For if you judge them, you have set the rules for how you should react to them, and then another answer cannot but produce confusion and uncertainty and fear. This is your major problem now. You still make up your minds and then decide to ask what you should do. And whatever you hear, and what you hear may not resolve the problem as you saw it first. This leads to fear because it contradicts what you perceive, and so you feel attacked and therefore angry. These are rules by which this will not happen, but it does occur at first to everyone who listens well. Okay? Everyone is going to have that resistance. We have trained ourselves to judge and then decide what to do. That's how the world trained us. That's how we were raised to respond. The Course is telling us that the goal needs to be set at the beginning before we encounter the decisions that need to be made. We need to decide at the beginning what our goal is. And then everything that doesn't lead to our goal can be easily recognized and dealt with. Okay, here's rule number two. Throughout the day, at any time you think of it, and have a quiet moment for reflection, tell yourself again the kind of day you want, the feelings you would have, the things you want to happen, and the things you would experience, and say, if I make no decisions by myself, this is the day that will be given me. The word given is in all caps. This is one of the things that gets the ego out of the way. The ego protests mightily that we're not making this happen. We are asking and receiving what we asked for. And the ego doesn't like that. And so that's going to be the source of a lot of our resistance to doing this practice. It's because we want to feel like we're the problem fixer, when in truth, when we're listening to that mindset, we become the problem creator. It's totally upside down, as everything the ego does, right? Okay, can you hold on just 1 second? I'm going to take a sip of water. Okay, thank you. These two procedures, practiced well, will serve to let you be directed without fear, for opposition will not first arise and then become a problem in itself. But there will still be times when you have judged, oh, now the answer will provoke attack unless you quickly straighten out your mind to want an answer that will work. Be certain that this has happened. If you feel yourself unwilling to sit by and ask to have the answer given you, this means that you have decided by yourself and cannot see the question. Now you need a quick restorative before you ask. In other words, we've already gone off in the ego spiral, right? The ego spiral is to perceive the problem as something that we need to take on and figure out and fix. And there's another place in the course where I just love it. It says, don't you have enough proof already that the way you do things is wrong? And I, at that point, I had like 45 years of life behind me. And I said, you know what? He's absolutely right. How much more proof do I need that, you know, this misfix-it aspect of my personality that I took so much pride in, that I cherished, that I valued so highly, that was my means for survival in the world. This is what people valued about me, was that I solved problems. And all of a sudden, it's saying, the solutions will be given you. What do you mean? That takes away my value. So my ego goes into all kinds of, you know, upset, and the resistance was very high. And it's just amazing when you start to do this, when you start to read and do the practice of the rules for decision, you start to understand that you can choose to struggle and let your ego be in control, in charge, and you can solve the problem. You can solve the symptom, but you haven't addressed the cause. And so by solving the problem, you simply have pushed it off into the future. And it has not only gone into the future, it's probably morphed into more problems. So if for every problem that we supposedly fix, we end up creating more. This is just a fact of the ego's world, and the science community even has a name for it. It's called the law of unintended consequences, because you fix what your five sensory perception tells you is wrong, but you're not looking at it with spiritual vision that sees the whole holographic problem, and so you're addressing a symptom that merely buries the problem, and it lays underground for a little while, and then it erupts like a volcano in a multitude of different things that didn't seem apparent at the beginning. Giving rules of decision give us the power and the methodology for turning it over to a higher mind that sees the entire problem and sees the cause and tells us to address the cause. And I'm going to give you an example of a very dramatic example in my life, probably in yours as well. September 11th, 2001, when I got up that morning and I turned on the TV set, there was the second airplane flying into the second tower in real time, and I just collapsed on the sofa. And thank God, I had been in the process of training myself to do the rules for decision, and I said, you know, I'm really getting to the place where I'm about to lose my peace. And the ego was immediately spinning, you know, in fear. This was war. You know, who was this? You know, the end of the world. You know, that's where the ego wanted to go. But I had already had a number of years, thank God, of training myself to get quiet, to create that center of the storm, that quiet center of the storm, and ask what's going on here. I'm about to lose my peace. I want to see this differently. And the little voice in my head said, address the cause, not the symptom. In other words, September 11th was a symptom, and we needed to address the cause of it. And I said, okay, what's the cause of it? And the word, the single word popped into my head, hopelessness. And I said, okay, I need to understand that better. And come to find out, when I did some research, that at the American War College, they discuss different types of warfare, and obviously that's their business. And a really interesting fact, terrorism is called the weapon of the weak. Isn't that interesting? Now, when you start to understand that terrorism is only utilized by people who see no other means of, in their minds, defending themselves, then you understand what to address. You understand the cause of that warfare is a sense of hopelessness in the people using terrorism. And then you get to address the cause. Instead of trying to kill off all your enemies, you start to see, you start to look for and find the reasons why they are your enemies in the first place. It would have been a better response than going to war. But the ego's way won. Anyway, for myself and for my peace, it made a huge difference. And it was because I had been doing the practice for so long, and I feel so blessed. And I was able to help a lot of people who were in great distress over it, simply because I was constantly keeping in mind that a greater mind had an answer for everyone's questions. And everyone that I dealt with, and I dealt with a lot of people the week of September 11th, because I worked in one of the major hotels here in Louisville at the time, and we had stranded passengers from all over the world, but primarily from Europe, planes that had been grounded. I was dealing with pilots, people who were, one pilot told me he wanted to take his plane as soon as they released it and was full of fuel, and he wanted to go to the Middle East and attack back. And he was telling me this, and you know, it was just so much bigger. This man's anguish was so much bigger than my little mind, my resources could possibly deal with. And that same practice, that same mindset that I had trained myself in for years, told me to ask that higher mind how to respond to this person. And just out of my mouth, never going through my brain pan, came a question to him: do you have a family? And he was stunned. He was, you know, he was like speechless for a second. I mean, he had been so angry, and this horror had just been spilling out of him. And the question, do you have a family, just stopped him in his tracks. And he was silent for a moment, and he just looked at me like, are you crazy? And he calmed down enough to respond to it. He said, yes, I have a wife and I have two kids. And I said, I don't know what this means, and I don't know what lies ahead of us as a result, but I believe that your family needs you now, and that would do more good. That is where you're needed. Others will decide our response to the people who did this, but your family needs you now. And it totally shifted that man. And that is not something I could have figured out how to do. That little scene was repeated over and over again with people. People in despair, people who were giving up, people who were suicidal. I was coming in contact with all of these people. And I am just so blessed and so grateful that I had the rules for decision as part of my toolbox for dealing with the whole concept of September 11th and the things that happened. And with a lot of course students that I've dealt with since then, it has helped them reframe everything that has happened since that event in how things happened in their lives. Anyway, remember once again, this is a reading, this is item 3. Remember once again the day you want, and recognize that something has occurred which is not part of it. Then realize that you have asked a question by yourself and must have said an answer in your terms. Then say, I have no question. I forgot what to decide. That's the getting quiet in the center of the storm. Okay? It's simply stepping back from where the ego wants to take you. And the ego always wants to take you into fear. That's a given, okay? Always train yourself when you see that negativity rising in yourself to step back into that space. This is the hardest part of doing the purification process, is letting go of our cherished response to fight back. That is our only response, the Course says, except to retreat. And we can retreat in fear, or we can retreat in determination to see a better way than the fight response. Okay? So, back to the reading. I have no question. I forgot what to decide. This cancels out the terms which you have set and lets the answer show you what the question must have really been. Try to observe this rule without delay, despite your opposition, for you have already gotten angry, and your fear of being answered in a different way from what your version of the question asks will gain momentum until you believe that the day you want is one in which you get your answer to your question. And you will not get it, for it would destroy the day by robbing you of what you really want. This can be very hard to realize when once you have decided by yourself the rules which promise you a happy day, but these decisions still can be undone by simple method which you can accept. Number 4, if you are so willing to receive, you cannot even let your question go. Or if you are so unwilling to receive, you cannot even let your question go. You can begin to change your mind with this. I'm going to stop. This is the most helpful line in the whole course. At least I can decide I do not like what I feel now. Okay, when you're not happy, can you get honest enough to understand and admit to yourself that you don't enjoy it? We get so used to being upset that we think it's natural. There are people who are addicted to adrenaline. If things are going well, they sabotage it. And I was one of those people. I was Miss Fix-It. You had to have a problem for me to have a value. So I would always be instigating problems. It was amazing. So then I was justifying myself and proving my value. It's just amazing. That was a huge investment on my part to have to let go of. And I thank God that there was something in me that was genuinely motivated to take this seriously and to learn to recognize those times when I was so attached to my question so that I could have my solution, so that I could have the value, the only value that my ego saw in me. And I had to let it go in exchange for seeing another value, a higher value, a better value than the old cherished me. So that I can have a me that's closer to the me that God created. Back to the reading. At least I can decide I do not like what I feel now. This much is obvious and paves the way for the next easy step, which follows like this. Step 5. Having decided that you do not like the way you feel, what could be easier than to continue with, and so I hope I have been wrong. I can't tell you. This is an aside. I can't tell you how many times, especially in my personal relationships, when I really love a person and we're on the outs, or I'm tempted to be on the outs with somebody, I'm tempted to be upset, this line keeps coming up in my mind. I so hope that I am wrong, that this relationship is on the rocks, or that this relationship isn't worth value, or that this person doesn't love me. I am so hopeful that my ego's perception, my 5-sensory perception, is wrong. Those of you who were listening last week heard me talking about how my lifelong perception, until the Course came into my life, was that my father had abandoned me as a small child. I was so angry with my life and my father for leaving me with my mother, who he knew was a rageaholic, that I couldn't see the situation clear enough to understand how hard he had fought for me. I had made faulty associations, and so I could not connect the dots properly until I did Lesson 78. In Lesson 78, when I could set my anger aside at my father, all of a sudden I had this new perception. I had hoped I was wrong. I had hoped that my father hadn't abandoned me. I had hoped that my father had loved me. But I couldn't get it that he did love me and that he didn't abandon me, that he fought with every resource at his disposal to stay in my life at a time when men didn't get custody. I had to let the anger go. I had to let my ego's perception go in order to see how much love was there. And when that relationship with my physical father began to heal, my relationship with my heavenly father also began to heal. They were in tandem. They were parallel. I thought my physical father had abandoned me and didn't love me. And that, in truth, was how I felt. God had abandoned me, and because he didn't love me, because I hadn't measured up. This is an incredible journey that we're on. And so, now back to the reading. Okay, so the last one is, and so I hope I have been wrong. This works against the sense of opposition and reminds you that help is not being thrust upon you, but is something that you want and that you need because you do not like the way you feel. This tiny opening will be enough to let you go ahead with just a few more steps. You need to let yourself be helped. Step number 6. Now you have reached the turning point because it has occurred to you that you will gain if what you have decided is not so. Until this point is reached, you will believe your happiness depends on being right. But this much reason you have now attained. You would be better off if you were wrong. This tiny grain of wisdom will suffice to take you further. You are not coerced, but merely hope to have a thing you want. And you can say in perfect honesty, I want another way to look at this. Now you have changed your mind about the day and have remembered what you really want. Its purpose has no longer been obscured by the insane belief you want it for the goal of being right when you are wrong. This is the readiness for asking brought to your awareness, for you cannot be in conflict when you ask for what you want and see that it is this for which you ask. Step 7. The final step is but the acknowledgement of lack of opposition to be helped. It is a statement of an open mind, not certain yet, but willing to be shown. And before I read that part, open mind, a mind that has cleaned a space for the truth to be written, or rather, more closely to truth, revealed, not obscured anymore by the blustering or squid ink, the defense mechanism we call the ego. If we can just wipe the slate clean, if we can just push it off to the side, then the truth will be welcomed and we can see it. So this is step 7. This is the final step. Quote, perhaps there is another way to look at this. What can I lose by asking? Okay, that's what the rules for decision are about. Getting us to the place where we acknowledge through these steps that there is a better way of seeing, that there is a solution possible that we just can't see when we're in upset, and that we want to see that better way, that we don't want to be upset. We'd much rather be loving. We'd much rather see a reason to give our love instead of a reason to withhold it. That's the truth in us. That's the real miracle impulse that lies deeply buried in the subconscious, underneath all the layers of toxins that we've accrued through our lifetime, of feeling abandoned and feeling powerless and feeling hopeless, feeling rejected, feeling persecuted, all of those negative emotions that we stuff into our subconscious because they're just too painful for us to deal with consciously. This is the way to get around that, by simply saying, I'm willing to put all that aside so that the real me can demonstrate itself, that the Christ in me can come forward, that this love for my brother, that this desire to see the real world, I'm going to get out of its way and let it manifest for me. Those are what the rules for decision help us to do. So, back to the reading. Thus, you are made ready for a question that makes sense, and so the answer will make sense as well. Nor will you fight against it, for you see that it is you who will be helped by it. It must be clear that it is easier to have a happy day if you prevent unhappiness from entering at all. But this takes practice in the rules which will protect you from the ravages of fear. When this has been achieved, the sorry dream of judgment has forever been undone. But meanwhile, you have need for practicing the rules for its undoing. Let us then consider once again the very first of the decisions which are offered here. We said you can begin a happy day with a determination not to make decisions by yourself. This seems to be a free decision in itself, and yet you cannot make decisions by yourself. The only question really is with what you choose to make them. That is really all. The first rule, then, is not coercion, but a simple statement of a simple fact. You will not make decisions by yourself, whatever you decide, for they are made with idols or with God, and you ask help of Christ or Antichrist, and which you choose will join with you and tell you what to do. This is one of the things that I was talking about last week. Who's your daddy? Are you going to choose to be a body, a physical limited being, the product of your physical parents? Are you going to identify with that little limited mortal self? Or are you going to identify with the spirit in you that is a child of God, a creation of God, an aspect of the Christ, we're told, that eternal, safe, and totally loving self can be allowed to manifest itself if you choose to do the rules for decision and choose to ask the Christ instead of the ego how to respond. Back to the reading. Your day is not at random. It is set by what you choose to live it with and how the friend whose counsel you have sought perceives your happiness. You always ask advice before you can decide on anything. Let this be understood, and you can see there cannot be coercion here, nor grounds for opposition that you may be free. There is no freedom from what must occur, and if you think there is, you must be wrong. The second rule as well is but a fact, for you and your advisor must agree on what you want before it can occur. Remember, set the goal at the beginning. Okay, it is but this agreement which permits all things to happen. Nothing can be caused without some form of union, be it with a dream of judgment or the voice for God. Decisions cause results because they are not made in isolation. They are made by you and your advisor, for yourself and for the world as well. The day you want to offer the world, for it will be what you have asked for and will reinforce the rule of your advisor through the world. Whose kingdom is the world for you today? What kind of day will you decide to have? It needs but two who would have happiness this day to promise it to all the world. It needs but two to understand that they cannot decide alone, to guarantee the joy they asked for will be wholly shared. For they have understood the basic law which makes decisions powerful and gives it all effects that it will ever have. It needs but two. These two are joined before there can be a decision. Let this be the one reminder that you keep in mind, and you will have the day you want and give it to the world by having it yourself. Your judgment has been lifted from the world by your decision for a happy day. And as you have received, so must you give. Oh, God. That's one of my favorite sections of the Course. It's the practical application of all of the beautiful theories. And we can debate the theories until we're blue in the face. But each of us is going to have a slightly different experience of them simply because our paths are different. All those threads that we bring to the Course are unique to us. And so, if we're waiting for perfect agreement on the exact definitions of different words or on the exact meanings of certain concepts in the Course, we're never going to get there. We're going to get there through practicing the rules for decision and understanding that love is what we choose. Seeing the results of using the rules for decision will prove to us that we are spirit, that we are safe, that we are loved, and that we can give love, no matter what the situation that our five senses perceive, no matter what our ego tells us, based on the proof, quote-unquote, that it brings us from our past, the present is what determines our future. In this present moment, we're being retrained. We are changing our mind as to who to consult with about making our decisions. Instead of going to our past, the collective experience of which is voiced by the ego, instead of premising our decisions on past experience, we refuse that decision-making and choose instead to listen for the voice for God, which allows for new experiences, and those new experiences will shift us qualitatively to seeing from a different perspective. One of my favorite movies is a movie based on a TV series. It's called Serenity. The TV series was called Firefly. And there's a line in that movie that really, it struck me. A preacher is talking to the hero, and the hero has just run away from the bad guy, and he's in hiding. And the preacher says, do you have... It's, you know, the hero says that he did something that was kind of foolish. He followed his heart when his head told him not to help someone. And the preacher looks at him and says, well, that's your way. And the hero looks at him and he says, I have a way. Is a way better than a plan? And when I heard that exchange between those two characters, I just sat back and I laughed and I said, yes, a way is so much better than a plan. The rules for decision are teaching us a new way of making decisions, a new way of expecting, a new way of thinking about the world. It is teaching us a new perspective. And from that different perspective, we have different perceptions, new experiences that form a whole new way of living. If you have a way and you stick to the way, your plan is irrelevant. The plan keeps adjusting to the circumstances. I wasn't planning on waking up on September 11th to a global disaster and a hideous scene before my physical eyes, but my way was not to respond to what I see with my physical eyes anymore. My way is to ask Spirit how to see it. And that way makes adjustments in how I respond. No commandments in A Course in Miracles. A new way of seeing, a new way of making decisions, a new level of understanding. And that, the Course says, is what comes before enlightenment, understanding. And from understanding, peace. And peace and understanding go together, and they come from the power of God. Anyway, I'm almost out of time, and I've run out of things to say, and I don't know if anybody has any questions, but I hope this has been helpful to you. I don't think it was an accident that Doug brought up the rules for decision in response to a question at the end of his session. I think that it's all in divine order, and this is something that is so huge and so important and so crucial to our getting to the place where we are, as Jesus described, real Christians while he walked the earth. This is how we get to being people who really love each other, who don't let their definitions and their theories and their concepts come between them, who don't even let the calls to war disturb their peace. It is a new way. It is a better way. It is the answer to Bill Thetford's plea from the heart. And I thank you all. I hope this has been of value. Yes, it is a practical tool. One of the things that my Tom says is that the Course is one of those things that is beyond understanding until you begin to practice it. And here is the tool that Jesus gave us. Oh, thank you, dear. Yes, trust. Trust for a teacher of God is the foundation of everything else. Just trust. You are not asked to trust the Holy Spirit any further than what he shows you, and what he shows you that you know you could not do for yourself. Isn't that amazing? The emphasis on trust in A Course in Miracles is huge. Faith and belief are mentioned, but trust is the foundation for both. Trust like a child. Trust that the Holy Spirit only wants your happiness, and that everything you do in collaboration with Him is turned to good. With that level of trust, one decision at a time, the whole world changes. And so I thank you. I'm sorry, my Tom's having a coughing fit, if you can hear that. I'm so sorry. Anyway, I'm not sure who's coming up, and I'll just give you a raspberry for that. I love him anyway. He needs a cigarette? I don't think so. Well, yeah, maybe he does. It sometimes helps him stop coughing. Ironic as that may sound. But anyway, does anybody have anything that they'd like to share? We've got 4 minutes, I think, before Regina comes on. And there was, oh, thank you. Yes, I will tell him. Thank you so much, Maz. God bless you. I guess it's just the close-up for me now to just tell you how much I look forward to this every week. And I have to tell Dove that I've been rehired by the Census Bureau, and so I'm going to need some time off in July, starting on the 11th through the beginning of August. Like I said, the Census Bureau, the government in general, every corporation out there could use some real good core students. Anyway, I've been hired on again, and I'm going to need my Sundays off again, and I'm going to miss being here so much. But I'm not going to focus on that. I'm just going to focus on being here right now and just loving every instant with you guys. Just understand that every person that's on this path with us makes it stronger. And so I appreciate each and every one of you. Every little step that you take, it may seem small to you, but it's huge to the rest of us. Every single step, every single choice made with the Holy Spirit is the choice for love. It's the choice to extend the fatherhood of God to each and every aspect of God's creation. It is to love what God loves. The capacity to love as God loves is within us. We just have to get out of its way, and we have to trust. And by seeing each other do that, it helps us grow and trust some more. I thank you for being on this path. I thank you for your love. I thank you for your being. And I thank you for the smile in my heart. And that's what I'm doing right now. I'm smiling with all my heart. And I'm going to yield the mic over to Dove for his introductions. And God bless you, each and every one. You bless me so much. Thank you, guys. Have a great week. See you next week. Bye.